I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to spend this hour talking about the presidential administration of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who, as the author reminds us, is remembered primarily for two matters: civil rights, considered a success, and the war in Vietnam, viewed almost universally as a disastrous mistake. The Great Society, he writes, it was perhaps the most comprehensive and ambitious effort to change the political, social, and economic landscape of the U.S. in all of the country's history. It established new policies and bureaucracies to deal not only with race relations, but also federal aid, education, medical aid for the poor and the elderly, immigration, environmental pollution, conservation, urban decay, the federal role in arts and humanities. Those policies and bureaucracies have, for the most part, survived, but many of the issues with which they dealt remain unsolved. Our guest this hour is the author of Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism. Randall Woods is our guest. He is the John A. Cooper Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Arkansas, the author of Shadow Warrior, and also award-winning biographies of LBJ and William Fulbright. Before we start talking about Lyndon Baines Johnson, I thought it might be interesting for us to hear a little of President Johnson, who could be, we were listening to some of his speeches this morning, very eloquent on these issues, and the history of why he became eloquent and took on these issues is to be found in the book and also very interesting. This is, we were looking for the Detroit speech that our guest writes about and couldn't find it anywhere, but this is a speech that President Johnson gave to Congress on March 15th of 1965, joint session of Congress, in which he was urging them to pass legislation that would dictate clear, uniform guidelines for voting, regardless of race or ethnicity, and allowing all citizens to register to vote free from harassment. Here's President Johnson.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. I urge every member of both parties, Americans of all religions and of all colors, from every section of this country, to join me in that cause. At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama.
President Johnson urging Congress to pass the Voting Rights Act. That was a speech in 1965. Randall Woods, thank you so much for being with us, for writing about him. As we were listening to him today, and you quote a lot of what he said in your book, he could be really an eloquent guy and has this historical panorama and this sense of urgency about the right thing to do now.
He did. And by the way, thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be on the program. He was not the orator that that John F. Kennedy was or Franklin Roosevelt, but in terms of tone or presentation. But if you look at the content of his speeches, the Voting Rights Act speech, after which comedian Dick Gregory said you could hear 20,000 African Americans unpacking their bags. His Cadillac Square speech in 64, they're amazingly eloquent and visionary sort of remarkably visionary. In today's environment, I think that he'd probably be laughed off the stage, but that was a different time.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about where all the ideas came from. Maybe not Voting Rights Act, but eventually it emerged into all kinds of pieces of legislation. But this idea of a great society, you write about this, that it took shape in his mind since he first heard on his parents' victrola the great commoner William Jennings Bryan.
Well, his parents were his parents were very public-minded. His father served several terms in the legislature. He was a teacher, a farmer, and his mother had been a teacher, and she was a sort of small-town journalist. They were both believed that educated people had an obligation to public service, and they were both ambitious people themselves. Those ambitions were unrealized, and they focused their hopes rather intensely on Lyndon Johnson, their eldest son. And Johnson, he grew in Texas is a generally conservative state, but he grew up in around Austin, 10th congressional district, which was a sort of liberal island in a sea of conservatism. He went to Washington as secretary to that district's congressman, and he was a great admirer of Franklin Roosevelt and an ardent New Dealer. Mm-hmm. He believed that the purpose of government was to create a better life for all citizens, he absorbed what historians came to call positive rights. Franklin Roosevelt argued that that Americans were entitled to so-called negative rights guaranteed under the Bill of Rights, the right to free speech, the right to religious practice, but also were entitled to positive rights, the right to a decent education, the right to a job, the right to adequate health care. And the New Deal began to deliver on that agenda, but certainly millions of people were left out, particularly minorities, particularly women. Agricultural workers were excluded from the Social Security, the domestic servants. Johnson wanted to complete the New Deal agenda, to expand on it. There were several issues that he was committed to personally, civil rights, education, and health care. But after he was elected president, he established 16 task forces gathering experts from the nation's colleges to deal with other issues of the day, having to do with consumer protection, conservation, the new environmentalism, urban renewal, those things. So, in part, the Great Society was Johnson, came from Johnson's background, but in part it came from the Kennedy administration and the sort of reform environment that existed in the early 1960s.
Mm-hmm. But it is true, you call this his reform vision was of, and indeed it was, massive, massive proportions. When you look at the 1,000 pieces of legislation in a four-year period of time, he was just moving along. He was going to do this, wasn't he?
Well, it was unprecedented. I mean, even compared to the New Deal. And he was intense, focused, obsessed even. He had something of a messiah complex. He was a man in a hurry. He told his assistants shortly after he became president, which of course was a total surprise to him, that they had about 24 months to enact this ambitious agenda. 36 at the most, mm-hmm. because the country was naturally conservative. The conservative coalition was still in place. He saw Vietnam on the horizon, he knew that to accomplish his goals, he was going to have to expend a lot of political capital.
Mm-hmm. Was he dismissed by the Kennedy administration and by JFK in particular?
I'm sorry, please.
Was he dismissed by President Kennedy?
He was. The Kennedys, he managed to make enemies of the Kennedys, political enemies of them. In 1956, Joe wanted Jack to run for the presidency and approached Lyndon about being his running mate, and Johnson wouldn't do it. And they were competitors for the 1960 nomination, and the Johnson campaign mentioned Kennedy's Addison disease and some other things, and particularly Bobby Kennedy, the president's President-elect's brother detested Johnson. But the Kennedys needed Texas. They needed a Southern Protestant, and they had to have Johnson on the ticket to win. But as vice president, he was shut out of Camelot. He was shut out of most major deliberations, and it was the most miserable time of his life. And indeed, on the day on the day Jack Kennedy was shot, Johnson was musing to himself that he had heard rumors that the Kennedys were going to drop him from the ticket in 64. So the furthest thing from his mind was that he was going to become president of the United States.
Yeah. And was there truth to those rumors?
Yes, there were. Bobby so desperately wanted to drop him from the ticket. I don't know whether Jack would have done that or not. He was still, particularly because of civil rights, he was still in difficult political position. So he may have decided to keep him on simply because he needed a Southern.
Mm-hmm. And how did he use, you write about this in the book, the martyrdom of JFK to advance his legislation?
Well, he used Kennedy's death very effectively. Kennedy was obviously more popular in death than he was in life, and Johnson was in part responsible for that. Lyndon Johnson made Jack Kennedy really the liberal that he became in the public's mind, and he implied to the American people that Kennedy was as committed to domestic reform, to this massive reform agenda that became the Great Society, as he, Lyndon Johnson, was. Where, in fact, Jack Kennedy, although a moderate, a liberal, he was much more interested in foreign affairs than he was in domestic policy.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking about LBJ this hour of the program and a really interesting new book from Randall Woods. Prisoners of Hope is the name of the book. Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism. Amazing to be reminded of all the legislation that passed from 1964 to 1968, mostly in the first 2 years, what we can look at now as a strong legacy from LBJ, but obviously what put him in disgrace was the war in Vietnam, and we'll talk about what Randall wrote about that and what his vision was of Vietnam and trying to extend democracy and being a victim of a Cold War mentality, so trying to extend a version of democracy to South Vietnam, not seeing what was at work in that country and putting forward a disastrous kind of policy. So we'll talk about that as we continue our conversation with the author of Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're looking at the Great Society programs of Lyndon B. Johnson with the author of Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism, and welcoming phone calls for the author of that book, Randall Woods. 800-486-8655 is our number. And let's start our calls with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen and guest. I take a bit of exception to your guest saying that Johnson might be laughed off the stage today because we've got at least one presidential candidate who seems to be doing imitations of Ethel Merman singing "We'll Be Great." But I had such a love-hate relationship with Johnson, wound up working in the poverty program in Southwest Texas, west side of San Antonio, with migrant workers. If you're anywhere around Texans, at least in the 60s, they had stories to tell about LBJ. And I'm wondering if your author has anything to say in his book or on the air about the contested 1948 election when he ran against former Governor Coke Stevenson in a primary, and John Connolly's role in that election results. I do think Johnson, the reason I miss Johnson is I do think he knew how to work politics and how to work a set of legislators. And I think we need that these days rather than the gridlock that we currently have. Thanks for taking my comments.
Thanks, Rich, for the call. Randall.
Yes, it's good to hear from a fellow Texan. I grew up in that area myself. I'm aware of all those stories. Johnson had actually been cheated out of the senatorial race earlier in the decade by Coke Stevenson and his allies. Johnson and Connally at that time were rather naive, and in 1948 they didn't make the same mistake, and so they were able to out manipulate their opponents. So there was that was just the nature of politics in the state at that time. What was the second part of the question? I'm sorry.
Well, I'm interested in his response because I wonder if you share the same feeling that he had kind of this love-hate relationship with Johnson, which I think a lot of people did, and this may move us into Vietnam, that a lot of people love the Great Society programs, but they hated Vietnam. They loved the fact that he was able to work the room but hated his kind of, you know, grossness, picking the dogs up by the ears and talking while you're in the bathroom. You know, that kind of thing was kind of gross.
Well, I mean, he was an enigma, and that's one of the reasons he was a wonderful subject for a biography. He could be crude, rude. He could be very hard on his associates. He used people up, as a lot of ambitious and successful people do. But he could also be quite he could be quite sophisticated. He could be quite sensitive. He was quite frankly borderline manic depressive.
Really?
Yes. He had a mentor earlier in his life, a man named Charles Marsh, a wealthy Texas businessman and newspaper person who was bipolar, and he sensed that in Johnson himself. Had these massive mood swings, depression, and this manic activity. He was also in poor health all of his life. He nearly died of a heart attack when he was 55. So there was this sort of intensity about him, and a kind of crudeness. I think part of the crudeness came from the fact that he was rejected by the Kennedys, by Camelot, and he tended to, when he was criticized about something or when he was stereotyped, he responded by acting out that stereotype frequently.
Interesting. And
he was absolutely a genius at congressional politics. Certainly, the best congressional politician in American history. And his mentor, Richard Russell, knew every congressman, every senator. They knew what their constituencies were like. Johnson never asked a senator or representative to cast a vote that would defeat him or her. But, for example, he wouldn't ask James Eastland, Mississippi, to vote for civil rights. But he said, you've been elected to represent the entire nation. He said, you may not can vote for the Voting Rights Act, but you can vote for Medicare or you can vote for the Elementary and Secondary Education Act.
Isn't that interesting? So he knew how to work people to get their vote because it would be in their interest to do so.
Yeah, and he knew what they couldn't lie to him. They couldn't. He knew what their each constituency was made up of, and he knew what a representative's constituency would put up with.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich, for your call. Let's go to Ed in West Dallas. Hi.
Salve, Kathleen. Well, a couple corrections before my main point. I thought that LBJ's main mentor was Sam Rayburn. And with John F. Kennedy, he might have had a flair for foreign relations and policy, but for those of us in organized labor, he certainly was our patron saint. And 168 hours before his death in Dallas, he gave one of the greatest labor speeches in history on November 15th, 1963, at the old Madison Square Garden that I hope everybody will get a chance to read. Now, my main point is this Dixiecrat, Johnson, voted for the Taft-Hartley amendments over Harry Truman's veto in 1947, this tremendously anti-union Southern Democrat who none of us in organized labor ever had any use for. And I think all of us were just aghast in 1960 when he made it on to the presidential ticket, because he had no love for organized labor whatsoever.
Randall.
Yes, hello?
Yes, go ahead. Your response.
Yes, well, he did. He was from when he was, again, representing, when he was in Congress representing the 10th Congressional District, he could assume a fairly pro-labor position. But once he became senator, you're quite right, he was anti-labor. He voted against Taft-Hartley. But after he became president, and indeed there was a wing, particularly United Auto Workers, opposed his selection as vice president. But after he became president, he began to win some support from labor, particularly from George Meany and the more conservative wing of the labor movement. And he was not a Dixiecrat. He considered any by any stretch of the imagination. He campaigned for Harry Truman. He did not sign the Southern Manifesto. One of two Southern senators not to do so.
Let's go next to Eugene and Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Oh, good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. I was going to school and teaching in the late 60s when that federal aid to education and those student loans came along. Those student loans were the reason I was able to get a degree in education. And when I got into low-income districts, though that federal aid was giving us the money to buy the supplies and things that we needed for the students. And for that, we were all saying thank you.
Randall.
Well, he certainly was, I think, as proud of federal aid to education, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and the Higher Education Act, as he was of any of his achievements. He believed, both his parents were teachers. He was a teacher, and he really believed that the key to prosperity and to social justice was education.
Let's talk a little bit about Vietnam before we go back to phone calls. We'll, of course, talk more about
sure.
it. You write that the export of liberalism to Southeast Asia, he believed, was the only true antidote to Marxism-Leninism. Vietnam, a crass political trade-off Johnson made to protect Great Society's liberalism and its supporters from the chronic attacks on Democrats as weak on defense. Did he also just not know what was going on there? Was foreign policy not his forte?
Well, I think he knew. He knew what was going on there. He didn't. He kept on Kennedy's foreign policy advisors. Dean Rusk and George Bundy and Robert McNamara, because he believed that, to use Halberstam's phrase, they were the best and the brightest.
Mm-hmm.
And he let them guide him on foreign policy. I think he accepted their views and took their expertise. He simply, I think he was informed, but he certainly didn't trust his judgment when it came to foreign policy as much as he did in domestic affairs. And I think he did defer to his advisors. Although he had, as the presidential tapes indicate, he had misgivings from the very beginning. He was reluctant to become involved, but once we did become involved, he, in his own mind, he tried to justify involvement by connecting it to the idealism that underlay the Great Society and civil rights. So that is, if it was incumbent upon America to extend equal opportunity and social justice to minorities at home, so too was it incumbent upon us to defend non-white peoples in the third world from the scourge of communist totalitarianism. certainly that was the message that Jack Kennedy had delivered. And Johnson, whether he believed that or not, he felt it was his duty to live up to that obligation.
Mm-hmm. And what were his thoughts when people started turning against him in massive numbers, demonstrations and the country exploding over this issue?
Oh, it was crushing for him. One of the great ironies of Johnson and the Great Society was that that he saw himself as a great compromiser, a great unifier.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to build consensus. He was the least partisan president probably in the 20th century. He got more Republican votes in 64 than Barry Goldwater did.
Wow.
And he believed that the reforms he were pursuing would unify the country. Instead, the anti-war movement, coupled with the white backlash that followed in the wake of Watts and Detroit and the other urban riots, had polarized the country by late 67 and 1968, as it had not been polarized, since almost the Civil War. And it was an ironic, a crushing irony as far as he was concerned.
Let's go to Bob in Manitowoc. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a couple of issues, I guess, with the fondness in which some people look at the LBJ's administration and ultimately his legacy. For example, the involvement in Southeast Asia with the incident in the Gulf of Tonkin, we all now know, which was made up. He was looking for something and kind of sold it to the American people as something that was genuine. And, of course, as history explains, that, you know, he actually made it up. And the other issue I have is, again, the Great Society and the social engineering that went on the ultimate, I think, you know, destruction of the family, and specifically, you know, the black families, and you know, what I think his legacy is kind of, you know, should show a little bit of that tarnish, and I'm not understanding why it's not. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call, Bob.
Well, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, the attacks on the 1st of August 1964 did occur. The second wave of attacks did not occur. But at the time, the administration, behind the White House, ordered retaliation against the North Vietnamese bases. At the time they ordered that, they believed that the attack had occurred. It was only later that they came to learn the truth. I must point out that Franklin Roosevelt in 1941 used a fabricated attack on an American destroyer, the USS Greer, by a German submarine, a Nazi submarine, to launch the undeclared naval war against the Germans. It was an almost exact duplicate of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, but the two wars are perceived very differently by history. I certainly wouldn't blame the difficulties of the black family on the Great Society. The Great Society, the War on Poverty, were designed to cure the ills of the citizens that dwelt in the nation's ghettos. But certainly the architects of the Great Society began to realize the limits of social engineering, because the ultimate logic of the Moynihan Report and the Wall of Poverty was to take the child away from the family. Mm-hmm. Which is Orwellian, and something that that of course any right thinking person would reject as Johnson and his associates did. So that has to do with some of the limits of reform.
that the title of the book implies.
Here's an issue that we're still debating so many many years later, as we are some of the focal points of the Great Society. There is a picture of members of the audience in your book at Howard University listening to LBJ deliver the 65 commencement address, in which he broaches the notion of affirmative action. How did that go down?
Yeah, I think that's a momentous address, and certainly the Kennedy administration had dealt with the concept of affirmative action, but it was very fuzzy in their collective mind. Johnson, in the Howard speech, used an analogy. He said, "You don't ask," referring to black Americans, African Americans, said, "You don't ask someone to compete in a race when everybody else has had a 50-yard head start," referring to the fact that slavery and Jim Crow and decades of oppression had left African Americans at a great disadvantage. And he called for affirmative action. Now, Johnson and his advisors later argued that they were talking about affirmative action, soft affirmative action. That is, a determination by bureaucracies and private entities not to discriminate in hiring. But he was also talking about equality of condition, and that was implied in affirmative action. And of course, the quality of condition would lead to quotas, hiring quotas, and what's called hard affirmative action, that really created a dilemma for liberals, for reformers, because throughout American history, representatives of women, minorities, labor, disadvantaged groups had called for equality. For equity, for equal treatment, and even liberals, even reform-minded Americans, were somewhat troubled about the notion of reverse discrimination.
We're talking this hour of the program about LBJ and the author of the book, Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism. Randall Woods is our guest. He is the John A. Cooper Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Arkansas and is the author of award-winning biographies of LBJ and William Fulbright, and also author of the book Shadow Warrior. When you think about LBJ, what do you think? Do you think that the Great Society was a wonderful thing, that he was a champion of liberals, that he did himself in because of Vietnam? Is he a disgraced president? Is he a president worth revisiting? And why is it that many of the issues that were a part of the 1960s, immigration, we'll talk about LBJ and immigration, certainly affirmative action is still with us, race is still with us in many ways, also health care in the country, environmental issues, the list goes on and on. 1,000 pieces of legislation, mostly in a 2-year period, but during the 4 years that he was president. Where do you put him in history? Is he worth knowing about? Of course he's worth knowing about. But how important was he? And the legacy he left. We welcome your phone calls. We have lines open for you at this very moment, actually. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We'd like to read your messages on our Facebook page. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Carol in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank
Good.
You. You know, I was just a kid when LBJ was president, but it's so timely now, especially in this state, that we're talking about what he did for voting rights. And, I mean, look at all that's happening as they try all over this country to water them down. And I think that's his claim to fame right there. That's all I have.
Thank you, Carol. Do you agree, Randall?
I certainly do. If you look, what Johnson was trying to do during the Great Society was to make full citizenship available to every American, and the Voting Rights Act was at the very, very, very heart of that. And what you've seen, I think, in the last few years is efforts to roll that back, to limit citizenship, to limit in terms of voter registration, in terms of immigration restriction, and so it's the forces that opposed reform in the 1960s didn't go away, they were permanent features of the American political landscape. And what's happened is that the reason we're still debating those issues is that opposition to those various reforms is deeply ingrained in American political culture, and they've come to predominate really in contemporary American politics.
Thank you, Carol, very much for your call. Tom in West Dallas. Hi.
Hi there. What you have forgotten, Kathleen, you and your guest, is something quite significant and that lives even now. They are the two most popular government programs next to Social Security. That is Medicare and Medicaid, which were both passed into law by President Johnson in a Democratic Congress, House and the Senate, in 1965.
Imagine those bills being able to pass today, Randall. It just wouldn't happen.
No, it would not. It's just inconceivable. It was a different time. It had to do with Johnson's political skill, but also there was a different. It was a different generation. In this day and time, the congressmen and senators have huge entourages. They rarely interact directly with each other. In the 60s, senators and congressmen, even though they were on different sides of the aisle, even though they were ideological opponents, knew each other, respected each other. For example, Hubert Humphrey and Richard Russell had great respect for each other. And you could see that on Bill Fulbright's Senate Foreign Relations Committee. They knew each other, and because of that, they could compromise, and they could work for the greater good. The idea that you should oppose that the political opposition should oppose something just because they're the political opposition was an anathema then.
And I also wanted to ask more. It's amazing all the legislation when you go down the list. Tell me more about the Immigration Act of 1965.
Sure. I think it's one of the most important measures that was passed. It did away with the old national origins basis for admitting immigrants into this country, which gave preference to white ethnic groups, to Northern and Western Europeans, as opposed to non-white and non-Protestant groups. This Immigration Act did away with the national origins it created a situation in which admission was based on occupation, family ties, there was no discrimination as to region. And what it did was to make the country as diverse in 2000 as it had been in 1900. Because beginning in the 1920s, nativists began to restrict and constrict immigration. The Immigration Act of 65 stopped that and helped create a more diverse country.
Mm. Let's go next to John in Brookfield. Hi, John.
I just had a quick comment that I might want to react to. Is it possible that things, such important legislation got passed in those days, maybe because we were only 30 years removed from the Great Depression and 20 years out of World War II, and especially as a soldier, but also in a rural society, you know that you have to rely on your neighbors and your family, and that maybe people were just more humane, and they started realizing when these things, as far as voting rights or anything, got brought in front of them, their attention, they started really thinking, so yeah, why don't these folks get the vote, and why can't we help them out? Things of that nature. I wonder if that helped.
Yeah.
That's a
very interesting point, and you certainly bring that up in the book, because it was a relatively peaceful, prosperous time. Here are some ideas that are going to really shake things up in this country, and yet he was able to shake things up in this country.
Well, I think it's a very astute observation.
Yes.
The people who had reached maturity in the 60s were members of what historians call the greatest generation, people who had lived through the Depression, people who had fought and defeated the forces of international fascism, and they'd gone quite irritated with the complacency of the 1950s. These people had a sense of mission, a sense of uniqueness, and I think Jack Kennedy touched on that. His call to create a better America really resonated. As your caller implied, at that point there wasn't this massive distrust of the federal government that you see now. People viewed at the end of the 50s and early 60s, people viewed the federal government as a positive force in American life. And so that certainly greased the wheels of reform.
Martha from Superior wants to know how LBJ was affected by the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy.
Well, I think he was certainly... devastated is the wrong word. I mean, everybody who lived in that time felt that Martin Luther King's assassination was almost inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And King himself believed that it was. What Johnson did was to use King's death to make a martyr of him, and that's what enabled Johnson to secure the passage of the Fair Housing Act in 1968. Fair housing was a much more contentious issue than equal accommodations or voting rights, and it encountered widespread, deep-seated opposition among whites in the North and the Midwest, people who supported the end of Jim Crow. But he used King's death quite effectively to secure passage of the Fair Housing Act. I think he was deeply saddened by Bobby Kennedy's assassination, shocked certainly by that. No one, I think, anticipated Bobby Kennedy's assassination.
Right.
Johnson, by that time, had announced that he wasn't going to run for a second term. Kennedy had declared his candidacy. I believe Johnson thought that Bobby Kennedy would be the next president.
And let's go back to the, because this is such a dramatic time in American history and so much violence, and it was just a hard, hard decade. You cite this incident, and I'm wondering how this played out. It's just a little snippet, but it's an interesting one. 1964, civil rights filibusters, Southerners holding out to prevent the bill from coming to a vote. LBJ President Johnson walks into a segregated Texas club with a beautiful African-American secretary on his arm, sending signals to Southern Democrats that he was on the side of racial reform. How did they respond to that? And why did he do that? That was an interesting thing for him to do.
Well, he was doing that. It was a segregated club, but he was in Austin, Texas. In Texas, Austin is sort of an island of liberalism. But it was also in your face, and
uh-huh.
Johnson was very much, particularly when it came to civil rights, he was very much in your face. His great friend and mentor, Richard Russell, told him that, and he was opposed to the Equal Accommodations Act and the Voting Rights Act. He told Lyndon Johnson, he said, Lyndon, you know, I'm going to fight tooth and nail to prevent these measures from being passed. And he said, if they're passed, you're going to have to run over me to do it. And he said, Dick, I'm going to run over you.
Huh. Interesting. And the relationship with Lady Bird. Lady Bird went on this Southern Swing Tour. There's a picture of all these young kind of Southern belles. How did he use Lady Bird to get friends in the South?
Yeah, this was in, pardon me, it was in 64, in the run-up to the 64 election. He'd already secured the passage of the 64 Equal Accommodations Act, and so, which of course was anathema to Southern segregationists. What he did with the Lady Bird and one of the Burrs and several of her political friends embarked on this whistle-stop campaign through the South. And what he wanted to do was to catch his native region and put them in a dilemma, making them choose between their traditional racism and their equally traditional gallantry toward women. And it proved quite effective. He wanted to test the waters too. He wanted to see really how the South would react. And it turned out much better than he anticipated. He met the train at the end of the tour in New Orleans and gave a rousing civil rights address to a large mixed crowd in New Orleans. And it was generally well received.
Let's go next to Rocky in Nescoro. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, how are we doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering if the authors are aware of how much money LBJ and his wife made off the Vietnam War.
How did they make money off the Vietnam War?
Well, she became a very major stockholder in three corporations. One was Sealant Corporation. Another one was Parnell, which provided electricity to the troops in Vietnam, and the other one was for scrapping of military goods that they didn't feel like jeeps and stuff like that. She was a major stockholder in all three of those corporations.
Randall?
I'm not familiar with that. They owned their wealth came from owning land in Central Texas. Johnson family owned the TV and radio stations in Austin. I don't know what the gentleman's talking about.
Yeah, where are you getting this information, Rocky?
I'd get my information. I was in this place called South Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
As a soldier, and it was passed on to me by other soldiers.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess it needs some kind of verification, because if anybody would know about this, it would be our guest, who's a presidential historian. LBJ was, is it fair to say, obsessed with his place in history? What is his place in history, and why was he obsessed with it?
He revered the presidency. He thought it was a student of American history in a very conventional sense, and traditionally Americans have thought of their history in terms of presidential administrations. They tend, it's not unrealistic to personify history, and he believed he had handed a great opportunity, and again he had something of a Messiah complex. In the early 80s, Johnson was rated toward the very bottom of American presidents. A recent poll that I read rated him in terms of domestic policy as the most effective president in the modern era.
Wow.
Including FDR. I never thought I'd hear this, but I attended a conference in New York where George McGovern spoke before his death. And George McGovern, an intense opponent of the war in Vietnam. And McGovern told a very large crowd that in his opinion, Lyndon Johnson was the greatest president of the 20th century next to Franklin Roosevelt.
Fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. It's a good one. Thank you, Randall.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Sure.
I've really enjoyed it.
Good. Randall Woods, the book is Prisoners of Hope, Lyndon B. Johnson, The Great Society, and the Limits of Liberalism. He is a distinguished professor of history at the University of Arkansas, also author of award-winning biographies of LBJ and William Fulbright. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing The Hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers and Lisa Nalbandian for production help, and thanks for all of your calls. Lots of calls on LBJ. Love it when you call about history. Till tomorrow.